A few of you are newer, but most of you know that Swami Kriyananda has come to America, the founder of Ananda, and he's staying at our house, has been since Saturday. There was a great deal of concern before he came about his health, because his health in Europe was, when he was in Europe, especially just the literally the last couple of days before he came, he had two bad falls. And the first time he fell backwards and got a hairline crack in his shoulder blade and just got all bummed up. So the next night, Anand, who was one of the leaders in the Assisi community, spent the night in his house, and Swami managed to fall again. This time he hit his head on something. He was set to go to Rome that day to do this huge... he was on his way to America, but he was supposed to dedicate the Rome Center. But by the time they got to Rome, he just wasn't well. So he actually didn't do the dedication, which is extremely rare for Swamiji, because it's just, you know, it's like maybe half a dozen times in the 40 years I've known him has he actually been too unwell to do something. For the next 4 weeks, my subject is love, human and divine. Sam, you had raised your hand a minute ago. Did I answer you?
Something else.
Okay. The subject being love, human, and divine is about relationships, and it's not merely about romantic, male, female, or intimate relationships, although we will cover that. We have 4 weeks, and what I'll do is probably tonight I'll lay a certain amount of groundwork of understanding of how we relate to people, and then I'll focus, you know, on couples and on work relationships and a few other things. Quite honestly, I'm not really quite sure how I'll do it, but that's how I often do it, so that's how I might do it. You never know. I haven't taught this class in a really long time, and so I don't want to come into it from the past. It's important to teach in the present moment. So I'm just going to wing it tonight, and we'll see where we are, which is really what I always do. But perhaps a little more so tonight. I have a lot of experience winging it, so it's not quite as irresponsible as it might seem. But what I was saying about Swamiji is everything that I know about relating to people, I learned from him. I came from a nice family. My parents were always good to me. I have, you know, a great deal of gratitude. They're both off the planet now. I have a great deal of gratitude, so it's not as if I was badly brought up and then all of a sudden, you know, he had to take me in hand and I was just a mess. Although in truth, he had to take me in hand and I was just a mess, but not obviously. You know, I was very functional mess. I was one of, you know, I appeared to get along fine. It was only deep in my heart that it was clear that I was going nowhere in a hurry, because what he brought to my understanding of life in terms of how to relate to people. I'm not even talking on a profound spiritual level. I mean, that's a whole nother dimension, which of course I will touch into. I'm just talking about how to relate to people, just how to be a friend, how to get along, how to not be an idiot, not to make enemies when you mean to make friends. Just name any characteristic about interactions with people, and I learned it from him. I've been, you know, his close friend and his devoted student since 1969. Friendship came a couple of years later because I didn't have a chance to know him until 1971. But so I'm going to constantly refer to him, because it's not merely that he's taught, but he's exemplified. And the lessons are crystal clear in my mind because I've seen them acted out. And I haven't seen them acted out like once or twice or occasionally. I've known this man very, very closely, literally for 40 years. You know, not literally, 38 years, let's be truthful, but almost 40 years. For many of those years, I saw him on a daily basis. And now I'm always in contact with him. I've witnessed it and I've received it. I've observed it and I've received it. And I understand that it's possible to relate to people on a level of refinement, on a level of authenticity, on a level of respect and unconditional love that people don't even know it's there, what to speak of knowing how to do it. And not in an airy-fairy kind of super theoretical way, but on a daily basis, because I'm not the only person he's related to all this time. Ananda community is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people and all over the world in 8 different languages. There are people who just think of him as their best friend with good cause. You know, not just a sentiment, because that's how they genuinely feel. So with that, you know, condition, I've also been married myself now for 25 years. I also have a divorce in my background. My first marriage came before I found Ananda. I was 19. It lasted for 5 years. It was not a foolish marriage. It was a very appropriate marriage. But we were utterly immature and didn't have the foggiest idea what to do with what was really very nice energy between us. And eventually we separated for spiritual reasons, because my passion became to be at Ananda, and that wasn't his. And it just, for me, there was no choice. And it wasn't difficult. He was into other realities. But when we talk, insofar as we talk about marriage, I have two realities. I have, oops, that one really didn't work, and there were really obvious reasons why that was a mess. Not based on it being a bad choice or him a bad person. And then I have 25 years with David, which I think I've handled a lot better. And I think the fruit speaks for itself in this case. So that's about the context. I can't think of anything else to say. This is also a class in which it's entirely possible to do this entire class just through questions, because everybody eventually asks everything that needs to be asked, and it all sort of comes together sooner or later. But I'm not going to start there. I'm going to first hold the mic to myself. Okay? Any questions or other thoughts that we need to deal with? Relating to other people is just both the biggest blessing and the greatest curse of being a human being. I think almost everyone knows that. We have absolutely wonderful experiences, and then we have near-death experiences on just a real steady basis. I'm just astonished, even now in my life, at the degree to which other people's words, actions, inconsiderations can affect me. I sometimes think, you know, will I ever grow up? You know, will this ever end? But it's just an amazing thing to me, certainly, and I have to be very more frank than that. You know, the difference between then and now is world's difference. More it's most of the time now, it's just observing. Oh, look at her, meaning me. She's getting a little upset about that. Why would she do that? And then I have to fight my way back into a good mood. And I'm by no means free of a great many things I would like to be free of very soon. But nonetheless, it's just it's an extraordinary teacher relating to other people, which is why we're born into these little groups. We start out, you know, you have to have at least 2, you know, to get you on the planet at all. Although I know now a woman can go to a sperm bank and doesn't really have to have anybody else involved. But at least somewhere there's 2, and then there's you. And if you, as a baby, don't stay with your parents, then somebody has to take you, or else you die. You know, human beings are simply not able to just be dropped on the sidewalk and then go forward from there. You know, little spiders can, little fishes can. There's lots of things that can just be dropped on the sidewalk and take care of themselves or into the pond, but human beings are not among them. From the very, very, very beginning, it's all about relationships. Conception starts with a relationship of some kind, and birth has to be some kind of a relationship. Sometimes they're beautiful relationships, sometimes they're hellish. But something's going to happen. Sri Yukteswar in The Holy Science addresses the issue in this way. He speaks about the fact, from this point of view, that Jesus said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." That word purity in heart is a complicated phrase, which I may come back to later, but just in essence what that means is the heart center, the heart chakra, which is related close to the physical heart, is the center within our subtle self in which, I want to use the word delusion, all of the duality that keeps us trapped in this world of illusion. This is where it's this point in this chakra is where it resides, what the yogis call the likes and dislikes of the heart. We look at everything in this world, and I spoke starting of the sperm and the ovum, the male and the female contribution to the forming of a new body. Everything in this world is dual. It's not just that you have men and women, but everything is there's always a rise and fall. You have dawn, you have dark, you have old age, you have youth, you have birth, you have death, you have laughter, you have sorrow, you have health, you have disease, you know, you have strength, you have weakness. Everything has an opposite because the way this world is created, it's created out of one spirit through the power of vibration. These are subtle concepts I don't want to go too far into, but the power of vibration, it's the Om sound that people talk about that you can hear. But the way Swami describes it is, it vibrates with such intensity that it gives the illusion that it's solid and you don't realize that it's a movement like this. He talked about the propeller of an airplane. When it's still, you know, it's one thing, but it spins so fast, it creates a picture that's different than the actual picture. But the clue to it all is that it's always in this alternating state. And yet, all the scriptures speak of the fact that spirit is just one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That's the classic prayer of the Jewish people, and it is a profound and a deep prayer. There's only one reality. But what keeps us from knowing that one reality is the fact that we're always being caught up in this duality. And we're caught up in this duality because we are deeply imbued with preferences. You know, I was just talking about Swamiji and his health, and I made the comment that his consciousness is completely outside of whatever his body's doing. I mean, he is simply in a state of bliss. It doesn't matter really whether he can walk or not walk. It doesn't matter whether he can use his left hand or not. It just doesn't make any difference to him because that's one thing that's happening in this world of duality. But his consciousness has centered on the unchanging reality of spirit that's behind everything. Well, the part in ourselves, in our heart chakra, is where we store all those likes and dislikes. I want to be young and beautiful. I want to have somebody love me. I want to have a baby. I want my child to get off drugs. I want to be rich. I don't want to be so poor. I don't want to be a man. I want to be a woman. I mean, just make a list. Just observe yourself for 6 or 7 minutes. And just see if you can possibly keep track enough to keep a tally before your mind says, I don't want to keep a tally, right? Just write down how many times you look at reality and say, I like it, I don't like it. 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 And yet, I'm sure all of you can assert with great, you know, philosophical certainty that everything is a manifestation of God, right? But nonetheless, we're looking at this total manifestation of God saying, I like it, I don't like it. I like it, I don't like it. I like it, I don't like it. And that, from the point of view of the chakras, which we may touch on more as we go through this class, from the point of view of the chakras, the heart chakra is where these vortices, is what they call them in the Patanjali Sutras, these whirlpools of all of our feelings whirl. We set a center point, we sort of anchor our feelings with this is how I want it to be, and then all the energy just whirls around it. I saw this woman, bless her heart, I still pray for her. We were just driving down and she was crossing from California Avenue across El Camino, and I just saw her from a distance, and she was, she needed to exercise. She was probably my age, maybe a little younger. Sometimes people who've lived hard are not as old as I think they are. So she was actually probably younger than I. Her body was completely out of shape, and she was carrying maybe 30 or 40 pounds more than she should have to be healthy. She had hair that she had changed the color of it, but badly, so that, you know, a great portion of it was whatever it was, and the rest of it had been monkeyed with. Just even just flashing by, she had her face all painted up. She had the clothes that she was wearing, or she must have bought them at a junior high school store. You know, just like trying to be really young, short skirt, spike heels, and, you know, she looked awful. There was just no way that you could really describe her as anything except looking awful. Maybe she lives in a world where people think she looks nice. I don't know. But to me, she looked awful because she was so divided against herself. You know, here she is. She's progressed to a certain point in her life, and at a certain point, a little bit of reality has to come into the picture, and you just have to say, you know, I'm not 17. And if I just could flow a little bit with being 57 or whatever she was, it would just be a little easier. And I just thought how sad she must be. You know, what does she see when she looks in the mirror in the morning, when she actually goes to her closet and put on that get-up, you know? She must have looked in the mirror. But somehow for her, it's just what she wanted to be. And I thought just to be, you know, you're getting older, and then cling this desperate thing. I don't want to get older. I want to be young. I want to be flashy. I want to be sexy. I want to be all the things I was. Just what a strain. And it's within our heart chakra that we establish these strong likes and dislikes, and it keeps us out of the one-pointed understanding of spirit. And the purity of heart, our natural state, is to be at peace with things as they are. It's an unnatural state, unnatural in the sense that it's not our lasting reality, to be discontented and always be filled with these, I want it, I don't want it. And when we can purify, when we can become what we truly are and get rid of the impurity of this false idea, then spirit stands revealed. Because spirit is always there. We're just so busy accepting and rejecting, that we miss that quiet voice. Be still and know. Be still is not just like that. It's having to still all that oscillating energy. Well, it's because of that energy, and I was starting to say with Sri Yukteswar, talking about the purity of the heart, Sri Yukteswar just talks about the stages that you have to go through. And one of the main teachers, until you reach a very high level, which probably none of us are on, just judging by the karmic conditions that we're in, until you reach a very high level, you are, the way he phrased it, you are compelled to interact with people. Because it's in seeing yourself reflected through the eyes and the feedback that you get from others that we get a window into our own consciousness. Interacting with people is the mirror in which we gradually become capable of understanding who and what we really are, what's really going on inside ourselves. Because the whole premise, which of course is the premise in a place called Ananda Church of Self-Realization, is that there's a goal to the game. This isn't just about, oh, let's just come in here and just figure out how to just squeeze as much satisfaction as we can out of these little bodies and this little life, you know, and then just, woo, go off into the big void. We're talking about something completely other than that. We're talking about a life that is given to us by God that has a real intent behind it, and that there are reasons for everything that happens, and those reasons are going toward that goal. And that goal is a magnificent one, which is that all that we experience is suffering, is entirely unnecessary, and when our consciousness reaches a certain point of refinement, it simply won't be there anymore. That what we think of is all this we have to go through, we don't have to go through it. Our destiny is, as Swamiji put it, I mean, not as Swami put it, but as all masters put it, but he put it in describing Ananda, we believe that the goal of life is Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, ever new joy. And that all the things that happen to us are just lessons in the great school of this life and many incarnations to bring us into a perfect relationship with Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, ever new joy. But because our hearts are oscillating all the time, we don't experience it. So, Sri Yukteswar says, we are compelled by our own karma to be in constant interaction with people in which, in the cold light of day, we get to find out who and what we actually are. Because the human capacity for self-deception is really impressive. It's really, really impressive. I think of that poor woman who thinks she's attractive. You know, it's just because she wants to be. Even my dear mother, I just loved my mother. She was so cute. That, like about 2 or 3 weeks before she died, a month before she died, she moved out of her house and she moved into this retirement community with my father, who lived several years after her. And she really, I think, just needed to get my father there, and then she was able to check out once he was settled. But, you know, she had an ordinary human vanity, not more extreme than any other person. But she was primping in front of the mirror before we were going to go into the dining room to have dinner. And she actually said, "No one would know I was 80. So what could I say? Of course not, Mother. You don't look 80 at all." But it was just like, does this never end? You know, at what point do we just say, "I'm 80 and I look every year of it. Maybe 86. Yeah, I know. I look in the mirror too. When I first like transitioned 45, 50, I'll be 60 in about a month, so that's how old I am. But when it really began to shift, I mean, some of you are past that point, some of you haven't yet crossed it, but when it really began to shift was, I guess, when I was approaching 50. There was about 4 years in there, and I kid you not, every morning I would get dressed and then I would change my clothes. I changed my clothes like 3 or 4 times. My body was the same size. I've been almost the same size most of my life. I just changed my clothes over and over. Nothing ever looked right. And it took me years to realize the problem was my head. You know, I just needed a different head, because no matter what I put on, I didn't look like myself anymore. Because I had just gotten accustomed. In fact, in the astral world, they say your body is about 27 or 26 or something. Like that's sort of the apex. And, you know, because I do yoga, because I'm a Kriya yogi and I energize, you know, we stay younger. But still, there's a point at which you can't fool anybody anymore. But it was just, I just couldn't believe that it took me that long to figure out what was happening. That I was just older now, and there was just, you can't beat it. Likes and dislikes of the heart. These are tiny, tiny things, friends, compared to real, real delusions. You know, these are jokes. But how many things? Oh, I wish my husband were different. I wish my children were different. I wish things had turned out different than they are. I wish I lived somewhere else. But we're always, the goal of spiritual life, you see, is not vague. It's not, even though it's subtle, it's not even slightly vague. It's not this sort of amorphous thing out there that you can just kind of be very, I think the word I want to use is woo-woo about, you know, just like this. It's just the ability on a daily basis to stand upright, be happy, respond appropriately, and go to bed in a state of perfect contentment that you did your best that day. And over a long period of time to become more and more able to be happy in your heart and to give that happiness to others. And in the meantime, God really wants us to get it. And we really begin to understand when we have to act it out in the cold light of day. I mean, one can think all kinds of things about how advanced we are. And then somebody just, you know, treats you just with a little less respect than you think you deserve. And all of a sudden, if you're a man, you might not be doing this. But if you're a woman, you're weeping in your pillow. Oh, nobody loves me. They've never loved me. My mother never loved me. My sister never loved me. Well, the whole litany, just whoosh, there you go. Just because somebody went like that and didn't think about you just exactly right. Our relationships with other people is when we find out of what stuff we're really made. And we couldn't live without it. Because that's when you find out what your likes and dislikes are. And I know everybody will defend, you know, what's, you have to have this and you have to have that. And no, actually you don't. You know, the goal is to become utterly selfless. And I don't mean that because you're suppressed. It's just because your consciousness has expanded to the point where you don't need anything from anybody. that you're really just there to give. Most of you come to our Sunday services, and enough of you do that I want to refer to it this way. In the Sunday service, when we do the Festival of Light, we talk about this little bird. It's the story of this little bird, and this little bird's progress through very quickly through all these stages of development. One day in the bird's life, we say in this poetic story, is like eons of our time, and the bird goes through these certain stages of development. And at first, the bird just thinks, well, it's all about me. I mean, what else would it be about? Of course it's about me. And the bird was created by God to be generous and giving and united to the world and selfless in its sympathies. But the bird gets out there and he starts flapping his wings and he starts having kind of a good time. You know, isn't that what happens to us? Think about our youth. You know, your parents say this is how you should behave, and you start kind of having a good time. And you think, this is really fun to be out here on my own like this. And so the bird decides that what else is wisdom, as he puts it, except to keep what is mine for myself. And then we say also, and even though repeatedly the little bird lost everything he had, still he kept his bonehead philosophy and clung to it. You know, even though he was smashed to the ground over and over. Sound familiar? I mean, you can probably just think of this incarnation. You're not even remembering how long it took you to get as dumb as you are, you know, and as wise as you are also, as I am. You know, we've spent a long time on this. So that bird, that's what happens. We just begin to think it's about me. And even though it keeps hurting us, we keep thinking that, maybe I just didn't do it right. That's one of the most charming delusions. I love that one. If it's not working, it must mean because I need to do more of it. And many times people, just whatever isn't working, they're just determined that they just have to do more of it. It takes a long time to realize that maybe my fundamental concept is wrong. So this little bird, you know, gets just smashed to little bits until finally, in the way the story is told, it can't go on, and it appeals, you know, help me. And the universe responds, you know, start cooperating with what's going on around you. Allow the forces of this world, pay attention to them and move with them. In other words, overcome at least some of your I want it to be this ways and move with it, and you'll find that it will give you strength rather than taking it away. And so the bird goes into the stage which they call the quest. It's a brilliant statement. The first stage, second stage, first you're created, then comes what's called the rebellion, which is, this is the way God made us, but I have my own ideas. And a great deal of misery in life. In fact, I dare say a gigantic amount of misery, in fact, a huge, humongous amount of misery, is just because we rebel against the way things are. And we actually think that if we just rebel hard enough, things will change. Think about it. It's a marvelous thing to sort of reflect on. If I just keep beating my head against the floor, maybe something new will happen. My sister raised her son. He's 18 years old now. He's a very fine lad. But he was a handful from the beginning. And she was very strong, very clear parent, both she and her husband, they were very clear. And I remember when he was about, and he was a, I think he was a New York lawyer in his last life, at least all through his childhood, that's how he behaved. He did and still does. He loves to argue. Just give him, open a conversation and he'll just argue it just for the sheer fun of it. Even as a very small child, and a huge vocabulary and very strong will. And my sister wanted him to do something that he really had to do. And he starts trying to talk her out of it. She just folds her hands and just looks at him and says, when I have spoken to you like this in the past, have I ever changed my mind? He said, no. She said, it's not going to happen this time either. You know, and that's how you had to deal with him. And fortunately, and he's smart, he got it. So that's it. She says, you have two ways. Either you're going to walk out of this door with me, and then when you go home, you can do whatever you want, or I'm going to carry you out, and when I go home, I'm going to close you up in your room. You have two choices. Those are your only choices. You know, and over time, they would negotiate it. But this is like Divine Mother's with us. When you break the fundamental divine law, Divine Mother says to you, do you think I'm still going to let you be happy? You think I'm going to just like make an exception in the way human beings are created just for you? Have I ever changed my mind when I've spoken to you like this? And nonetheless, we still just keep trying and trying and trying and trying. That's called the rebellion. I want it to be easier. I actually said once to Swami, to my everlasting embarrassment, I don't remember, oh, I do remember, but I won't say. There was something going on that I had to face it, and I didn't want to face it. It was pretty simple. I just didn't want to face it. And I actually was just, I used to cry a lot more than I cry now. But I was crying about it and saying something, oh, life would just be so much easier if I didn't have to deal with this. He didn't say a single word. He didn't say a word. He just looked at me. He just like that. He's articulated on one other occasion when I said something to him, made this, what I thought was a brilliant idea, and he said to me, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard, is what he said. It was appropriate response then, but this was the look, you know. I was too upset. He couldn't say something like that. He just stared at me and just let me listen to what I had just said. Oh, if only everything were different, things would be better. Like, where are you going to go with that? Like, where is that ever going to take you? Except in utterly pointless circles, bashing into the wall. I used to do a lot of counseling. I've started doing a little more again, but for many years I did a great deal of counseling. And I realized that many times you sort of get syndromes, no matter what people are talking about. And there was a syndrome I used to call the desperate search for the mythical third alternative. This is how a person of my temperament entertains themselves in their quiet moments. The desperate search for the mythical third alternative. Somebody's sitting in front of you. They have a life situation they have to deal with. And they have to do this, or they have to do that. It's really like, you're going to have to do one of them, you're going to have to do this, you're going to have to do that. But both of them involve things they don't want to have to deal with. So they solve the problem very neatly by just pretending that there's a third alternative, if God would only reveal it. And they just fight desperately to have someone. People we used to joke about in Ananda, because there's many of us in positions of leadership, and in a community, people have many friends, and there were people we used to call serial counselors. Counselees, serial counselees. They would just go from one to the next, to the next, to the next. You know, she didn't tell me what I wanted, maybe he will. He didn't tell me what I wanted, maybe she will. Just in desperate search of the mythical third alternative. Other than just saying, this is the hand that life has dealt me. And there has to be a reason for it, and therefore I need to just go into it. It doesn't mean that you don't act. It doesn't mean that you don't apply dynamic will. But in fact, it does mean all those things. To accept something, it doesn't mean you become passive about it. It just means it becomes the actual conditions under which you are working. Instead of just pretending that this doesn't exist, I think of it sometimes like if you get your leg cut off in some accident. A young friend of mine was, you know, very strong, athletic man, in a freak motorcycle accident, ended up with, you know, no leg below the knee. And he was just extraordinary about it. It's just like, all right, I don't have a leg below the knee anymore. And he just went through the whole thing, put on one of those prostheses, and just started acting as a young man now who doesn't have a leg below the knee on one side. But he just accepted it right from the start, and he acted accordingly, but not passively. You know, not in anything, but what if he just lain in bed and just moaned about it? You know, felt sorry for himself. Who will I be? I'm not even 20 years old and I don't even, you know, all the things he could have said. He was very, very successful athletically. Not a professional, but just, you know, he just really had, they still is. But you just, this is reality. Or, I've made a real mess of my life. You know, I've behaved like a real chump. And here I am at whatever age I am, and these are the circumstances I've created for myself. To accept it doesn't mean that you die in it. It just says these are the conditions. I need to start behaving accordingly. But see, we have likes and dislikes. We have all these preferences of the heart. I wish it were different than it is. But other people keep us honest. Because try as we might, and we try mightily, they have a really nasty habit of just being themselves. One of the things I've learned in marriage, and that's made my marriage much more harmonious once I finally got a hold of it, is that David is never going to be me. Isn't that startling? There was a whole period of time when I was doing a lot of marriage counseling, and it's usually the women who come. Sometimes the men come, but usually the women. And I began to realize that many women who came to me had fundamentally good relationships. Rarely, and it does happen, do you meet a relationship in which there's actually something wrong with the relationship. Usually what's wrong is with the individuals. And, you know, it's not really the interaction. It's just that both of them have established positions and they're not going to reach each other. But sometimes there's nothing that can be done. The karma has gone as far as it can. When I divorced, I asked Swami, because I was already deeply involved with Ananda by that point. I said to him, it was a very serious question for me, because my first husband is a very fine man, and we had this instant connection with each other. We had an enormous number of things in common, and we were just really unified, and we were too unified. That was what was wrong with us, but we just didn't have a way to be ourselves. But I said to Swami, you know, there was a time when the sun rose and set on this man, as far as I was concerned, and I just couldn't go a day without being with him. And now, you know, I just would really like to be on my own. I said, the question was, how can I ever trust myself again? How can I know what's right or not right? And Swami said, karma has cycles. First thing I said, he said, karma has cycles. He said, maybe the karma between you is over. He let me sort of have that for about 8 seconds. And then he said, but I don't think so. But he said, but you've taken it as far as you can go. This is a simple answer. You've taken it as far as you can go together. Now you have to put it on the shelf, develop in other ways, and maybe you can overcome your unlearned lessons with other people or within yourself. It doesn't mean that you have to come exactly back with that person, but you have to both grow in other ways before you can deal with whatever's left in that particular relationship. An interesting answer, isn't it? Now, where was I going to say before I went there? Well, I have no idea what I was saying before I went there. Well, I guess what I was just trying to say is that other people are what constantly goad us into having to change also, because it's that incentive of the suffering that we endure, the loneliness that we endure, the unfulfilled desires that compel us and to our spiritual benefit. So don't think that you're being more spiritual by saying, oh, you know, I don't want to get involved, I'll just stay out of it. Almost no one who has that kind of an attitude has actually transcended it. Almost everyone who has that kind of an attitude is afraid of it and is underneath it. If you really have that kind of an attitude, you're generally quite involved with people without even thinking about it. You might not be married, you might not have children, but you just relate in a very free and natural way, like Swami Kriyananda is a very good example. Well, he's an exceptional example, involved with thousands of people, but from just a place of complete freedom. It's not about anything he needs or has to learn. It's just, it's the nature of a flower to give off fragrance and beauty. So why would I not do it? But it's the nature of all of us to give off fragrance and beauty, but we also have a lot of thorns. Oh, I know what I was saying. People have a way of not conforming to what you want. And I was talking about how David just will never be me, which has made a lot more harmony once I figured that out. First, I thought if I just worked a little harder, he would. He made it quite clear to me that he never would. I was a little shocked when I finally realized that. But I was saying I was doing all this counseling and the women would come, and I gradually began to understand that all that the women were asking, it seemed like so little to them. Just a little bit of change here, a little bit of change there, was just about the difference between a woman and a man. You know, because women and men are a great deal alike. Naturally, I mean, all people are a great deal alike. But it's just like, and men, universally, would have nothing to do, would just steadfastly and with enormous determination defend the turf they were standing on because they were born men. They didn't want to be women. If they had wanted to be women or wanted to learn women's lessons, they probably would have chosen a woman's body. Now, I understand that all gender things are all mixed up a little bit in this age, but let's just say yin and yang. You know, most men are more yang, most women are more yin. And that's how you want it to be. That's what you came in to learn. And I finally watched enough men, and I just really saw them. It's like the woman will just try to coax out of him just a lot more of the kind of response she gets from her girlfriends. And she gets so aggravated that he won't respond like her girlfriends. But he looks at it, and I usually make a lot of good men friends when I teach these classes because I get the male point of view. I really do see it. And I really understand. He looks at it and he thinks, yeah, I do. He thinks, God, why would I want to be like that? It's just like it's not attractive. Swami wrote these books, this whole series of books called Secrets. They're lovely series of books. They're deceptively simple. They're beautiful, deep books. And they were, for a while, they were making a lot of money. Now many, many people have written these little books like this all over the place. But believe it or not, we started that. And Swami just got in there with a whole series of them, and for a while they were kind of a cash cow for us. Plus, they were really good books, so it wasn't like we were selling out. But the man who was selling them said, you know, most of these books are bought by women, and what you really need is a Secrets for Women, you know, how to be a woman. Swami's first response is, I can't write that. And then the next morning he woke up and he started writing it. And these are little books with 30 aphorisms, 31 aphorisms. They're like monthly books. And there's a little book called Secrets for Women. It's beautiful. For about 4 or 5 days, he just completely immersed himself in a feminine consciousness and wrote that book. And he said people would, you know, he wasn't in complete isolation, and people would call him with questions or want him to make decisions, and he found that his mind was too feminine. He couldn't respond in his normal manner. He's very androgynous, but he just shifted over to the feminine side. And then he wrote this book, and then he sort of finished with it, and it was done. Now, I'm saying this, please don't react. I don't think any of you will. You have to understand this comes from a very relaxed state of mind. He sort of started telling a lot of us, women friends. He said, really, I just completely immersed myself in a woman's consciousness. It was terrible. He said, just this endless pool of emotions and feelings rising and falling. He said, oh, I just wouldn't do it for anything. But, you know, for us, it's like, why can't he just be a little more sensitive? Right? Because he just doesn't want anything to do with it. Just what a drag. I remember Swami gave a wedding ceremony once. And he just to try to help this couple understand, he said, you know, the symbol of the male is the sun, the symbol of the female is the moon. That's all mythology has it that way, and that's the big duality, the sun and the moon. He said, the sun, it does change, but very, very slowly. Mostly it just rises and sets. It just rises and sets on a very steady, predictable way, where the moon waxes and wanes, it waxes and wanes, it waxes and wanes. And wanes. You know, you just like any moment it's going somewhere and then going back. And that's just what it's like. I mean, as a woman, I'm not so fond of it either, but I think it has a lot of good points. You know, we're just so sensitive. You know, like that. But I watch, you know, that's not what a man came to learn. He wants to. That's not what the male energy comes to learn. I don't want to polarize this too much into genders. But the male energy is about setting its goal, and it doesn't care how it feels. It's not interested in how it feels in this moment and what this is and what that is. You know, it's just got that goal, and it's going to put out its willpower, and it's just going to go there and get it. And believe me, women need a lot of that. Every human being needs a lot of this. This is yin and yang. Now, the male, the yang, gets carried away. And it just kind of starts barreling over everyone because it's just got its eye on its goal and it doesn't care how it feels. And the yin gets so involved in how it feels. You know, 15 years later, it's just feeling. You know, it's just still sitting there. You need both of them. The balance is needed. But women try to make the men change, and they're not going to change. They shouldn't change. It's not right for them to change. And it's the whole sort of big reality of I want it to be different. I'm just going to rebel against the way it is. I mean, I spent so many years of my marriage making my husband's life miserable. I'm talking about David. I'm not talking about the wonderful fellow from the past. I'm talking about the present one. I mean, just making his life miserable in this very false idea of thinking that he wanted to know all the things that I wanted him to know about how he could be so much better if he just weren't who he is. I mean, it sounds so wacky, even to me now. But I just thought if I just kept reminding him, then he would change. And he finally made it extremely clear to me that not only was he never going to change, he thought it was a really bad idea for him to change. And I finally really looked at him and thought, he's going somewhere else. You know, he's not trying to go, he's not even trying to go where I'm going. He has a whole different karmic setup and he's trying to go somewhere else. And I mean, all the years that I've been on the spiritual path, but you see, in very close quarters, you get confused. And only in very close quarters sometimes can you just peel away layer after layer. And for me, it's like I've been in Ananda communities since 1971 with a lot of the same people. No, it's a huge extended family. I've had the same friends for decades, and I've been through a lot with those friends. You know, and it's a fantastic opportunity to learn. And all of you have people in your life, short or long, who are always telling you what you're really putting out. Not what you think you're putting out, but what you're really putting out. And sometimes your friends are wrong, and sometimes they're right. Sometimes your mother is wrong, sometimes your mother is right. But it's all about this opportunity to hone our own nature to become more and more Christ-like. Nothing less, really. I mean, that's the whole goal. Not because God is stern and is demanding it of us and doesn't want us to be happy and get anything that we want. Nothing of that. It's because once we move out of rebellion, and see, rebellion says, this will make me happy. I'll be this way and it will make me happy. And when it doesn't, even though repeatedly we lose everything we have, had, we cling to it. But then when we get beaten down enough in rebellion, we go on the quest. And that doesn't make us perfect. That just makes us suddenly interested in saying, what's really going on? What's really true? Where does my happiness really come from? Okay, why don't we take a short break? Okay, let's go again. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. Does anyone have any comments or questions? Okay. Yes, Sarah. We pass the mic around because a lot of people listen to these things on tape or now through the MP3 on the internet. And for the last...
This is the mic.
That is the mic. For the last 30 years, they haven't been able to hear the questions, and we finally got this idea going.
So I guess what I'm hearing... Well, thinking about... you know, male and female, that it would behoove women, say, for instance, to try to develop more male energy for more balance and vice versa?
Well, that's a little simple way to say it. Let's put it like this. Whoops, wait, they gave me all this. Oh, they did. They gave me something to write with. Male-female is really loaded words these days, and not everybody lives the temperament of the gender they were born into, and you just can't rely on anything. So that's why I always go yin-yang. You know the little yin-yang? I'm very lousy at drawing, but little yin-yang has that little lovely little, what is the little double paisley? That was really badly drawn, but you get the point. Let's imagine that it's really perfect, like that. What are you dealing with? You're dealing with a circle. You're dealing with a circle that has two halves. Neither half of it is complete. It doesn't function as a circle unless you have both halves. So male and female are very close to each other. Men and women are extremely similar. I mean, the differences are just so small because gender is very, very temporary. We know the soul doesn't have a gender. You just come into a body and, Joyce, you're going to have to move because now you're dead behind Edwin. I'm just joking. You just disappeared behind Edwin completely when I stepped over. Okay. The soul doesn't have a gender. You are male sometimes, female sometimes, just depends on what you need to balance. But in the end, you become a perfect whole. And so you have to just ask yourself, the word that I love to use is the word appropriate. And when I start talking more, which I may get to tonight, appropriate is a marvelous word. Because that's how what you have to be. You have to be appropriate in all situations. In some situations, feminine energy, yin energy, is simply what's required. You know, somebody's dying. It's really dopey to come in and say, buck up, lad, you know? It's just like, you have to, it's just not the time. It's the time to hold a person's hand and talk to them about the world that's coming and make them feel loved. You know, you have to be yin. And there's other times when it's time to say, buck up, lad. Just stop feeling so sorry for yourself. Pull up your socks and go to work. And that's just exactly what's required. I mean, whether you're dealing with others or whether you're dealing with yourself, you can't, in the relationship that I have with David, and largely because, I mean, it's facilitated by the fact, one, that we don't have children, and that we've never had children. We don't have them now, and we never did, which goes together. And that we work together and that we're interested in the same things. We have a lot of similarities. And because we're both androgynous, you know, we shift a lot, both of us. That what I began to understand from observing us, because there was no necessity, temperamentally or practically, for either of us to hold any particular role. You know, if I'd had babies and I wanted to stay home and you know, nurse them and take care of them, and if he was the only breadwinner, I mean, those sorts of things start forming the way you have to relate, but we didn't have any of those forms. So I was able to just watch that to make a home with someone else, whatever the context, you have to have both yin and yang energy. You have to have enough yang to make it happen, you know, to just keep moving life forward. And you have to have enough yin for it to be a place that you want to be in. And I would watch. Our particular inclination, both of us, is that we both go a little too yang. We're both very entrepreneurial, dynamic in an outward sort of way. And so our lives would tend to just start moving that way. And then there would be a certain just lack of balance or lack of harmony sometimes. Just and all the conversation would be, well, what, did you talk to them? Yes, I talked to him. Did you do this? Yes. Well, no, I did that. Well, you take care of this, and then I'll take care of that. And kind of dryness would set in. And you just realize that somebody around here has to, like, develop some yin. And you'd look, and the refrigerator would be empty, and the clothes would be piled up. And I remember once David, he had this shirt, and he wore it, and he got it dirty. And then he very carefully hung it back in the closet. I said, honey, that needs to be laundered. Where are you hiding that back in the closet? He said, well, at least then I can look at it. He said, if I put it in the laundry, I'll never see it again. You know, and I looked at this pile of things that I was to deal with that I'd never dealt with. And, you know, so you realize that things have gotten out of balance. So I started, I don't clean. Before we got married, I told him, I don't clean houses. I just want this understood. I will cook. I will wash dishes. I will take care of your clothes, but I will not vacuum, and I will not clean a bathtub. I just want it understood. I will work extra hours to hire someone, but I will never do it. And I think I have never cleaned a bathtub. I have vacuumed on occasion, but I just won't. It's just awful. I won't do it. He said, fine. He said, he doesn't mind cleaning. His mother trained him well, and he cleans for years. Now we pay someone to do it, but for years he just cleaned, and I did my part. So, but my part was that he could put his shirts in the laundry and they would show up in his closet again. But I was falling off. But, you know, it was just like a signal. It's like you have to put out a little nurturing energy or else the whole ship goes down. There's no food in the refrigerator. There's no home life. There's just nothing happening. And the reality that we worked out is just whoever had the most yin to spare just started putting it into this story. And it wouldn't necessarily be me or him. He'd just suddenly come home with groceries, which would inspire me to make a meal. And then while I was making a meal, maybe all iron, you know? And it just, and things start, maybe we need some flowers on the deck. And then I get too busy and he has to water them. But it just, if you don't have both of it, it won't function. So therefore, look at your own life. You don't, I mean, just having another person in your life only is the catalyst for what you have to do. Look at your own life. Are you just being too yin, waiting to be rescued? Are you just being too yang because you don't want to just be sensitive enough? And a lot of times we're just sitting around waiting for someone else to fill in the holes. We're just quietly sitting there like half of the yin yang, just like waiting for someone to come in and make it happen. But the odd thing is, when you're all like that, you tend to attract people who are just like you, because that's how it is, like attracts like. You get somebody else who's also waiting to be rescued. Waiting to be rescued is another one of those lovely phrases, like the mythical third alternative. Waiting to be rescued is quite interesting. I had this experience a number of years ago. Swami Kriyananda asked David and me to come here 20 years ago now. And at that time in Ananda's history, nobody did the same thing for 20 years. Now quite a few of us have done the same thing for 20 years. Partly we had only been around for around 20. We'd all done all kinds of things. But several times, three different times, twice for real and once out of a misunderstanding, we thought we were going to be transferred to some other assignment. One lasted for 24 hours and was eventually removed and we stayed. The other was considered for a while. That lasted about a week, but then it proved impractical. And the third time, he never intended to transfer. I just misunderstood him. But each time, and then after that, he pretty much said to us, I hope you like it there. Because just the way things were developing and time passing, he just didn't really see us. There were lots of other things we could have done. I thought I'd start quite a few colonies. I didn't realize I'd only start one. Be part of starting one. But it was amazing to me when it finally really penetrated that it was very, very likely that I would never do anything else. I would always live here. I would never live anywhere else. The levels of waiting to be rescued that I didn't even know were in there. Just people that I hadn't really quite figured out how to appreciate or get along with, that I had always thought I would eventually just get to go away. A closet that just was a mess and that I was just waiting to move before I dealt with it. A corner of the garden where nothing would grow. Just amazing, amazing number of levels of myself that I was just hoping to outlast rather than ever deal with. Now, I think how much energy is tied up in that. Just think how that wears us out. And in so many circumstances, we're just waiting for something else to happen. And a great deal of what we're waiting for happen is for other people, in one form or another, either to show up if they're not there already, or to change and start filling in the spaces in the right way. But this is what the end point is. You never even... That's the great myth of marriage. It's very hard, especially for people who are relatively happily married or very happily married. When you speak to people who aren't married, you try to say... I remember this woman asked me, very sweet. She said, a lot of you people, married ministers, at Ananda, a lot of us couples serve in spiritual leadership roles. You never talk about marriage as a spiritual path. She said, it would be helpful if you talked more about marriage as a spiritual path. So I thought, gee, that's an interesting idea. So I spent the evening thinking about it, and the next morning I said, because it isn't. That's why we don't talk about it. Because there's the spiritual path, and part of the spiritual path is relating to people. And one of the ways you relate is by being married, if that's your karma. But there's nothing... Being married is just a super colossal friendship. It's just a great big friendship. It's not anything else. It has certain characteristics about it. If you have children together, it has all sorts of... But still, all it ever is just being friends. Master, it's very interesting, Master... said that the purest form of relationship is friendship. Because friendship is the only relationship where there is no coercive element. There's no element of compulsion in friendship. And all other relationships, employees, marriage, siblings, parent-child, child-parent, there's always some element where you're compelled to relate. Friendship is the one that's freely chosen. And you do it only and entirely because it's the spontaneous expression of your true heart. And therefore, the basis of all your relationships needs to be friendship. Because anything else is just relying on form, not relying on the genuine reality of who you are in your heart and who that person is. And that's the goofiness. We get close with people, we give birth to them, and all of a sudden we start behaving as if there was some other basis for relationships than friendship. You see what I mean? You see how dangerous that is? Before I married David, when we were together, I had this great desire to be married. I just had this imaginary thought in my mind that somehow once we were married, something would happen. And I finally had to just really think, you know, we're either friends or we're not. Being married will not make us friends if we're not already friends. And if we're already friends, I mean, it was lovely to get married. I think it's a sacrament. I think it's a real thing to do. I favor it. I have encouraged many people just to be lifelong lovers because I think it's a better deal for them. I'm not a traditionalist, but I do favor marriage. But you're either friends or you're not. I've said that to so many parents about their children. Look, you're either friends or you're not. The mere fact that they're your kids does not mean you even like each other. What to speak of having anything in common? You know, they rely on you for a while, then they get to be adults, and you're either friends or you're not. Just look at it that way. But because of the freedom and the respect and the sense that, you know, nobody's going to be your friend if you're just trying to get something from them or if you're just persistently half a person waiting for them to pick up the slack. And you don't even expect your friends to be like that because you know they have the freedom to walk out on you. And so it makes you more honest. But a lot of people in intimate relationships, family relationships, even business relationships, just behave like cripples. And somehow think it's just fine. It's fine as long as you want to suffer because we're not made that way. The goal is wholeness. The reason, as a rule, male partners with female is because they give to each other the opposite energy. And then, but it's not that they give to each other the opposite energy in order to avoid having to develop it yourself, but because you begin to understand it, you begin to work with it. You know, by my relationships with men, my association with men, my relationship with my husband, I've just really come to really appreciate the male energy and really respect it, really admire it. I mean, I've always been a relatively speaking masculine kind of woman, but not in ways that really mattered. I learned that. I've shared this with some of you. I learned this from Raghu. Most of you know Raghu. He's a big man. He's part of the community here. He leads the chanting. He's a very strong man. I've known him, I don't know, how long has he been at Ananda? 30 years maybe? And we've been here together for all the 20 years that we've here. He's just a wonderful soul. We did a class together on affirmations. And we were sharing the load, and he had the responsibility for choosing an affirmation out of Master's book and then leading the group and chanting it. So, you know, I weigh maybe about a third of what Raghu weighs, and I'm about, you know, I come up to about here on him. He's a big person, has a big voice, and I don't. We sit next to each other on these two little chairs, and there's a small group in front of us, and then Raghu starts the affirmation. The affirmation he chose is one I didn't even know was in the book. It says, I am strong, I am strong, I am powerful, I am strong, I am strength, I am strong, like this. And he just goes booming voice like this, I am strong, I am strong. My first reaction is to say, no, no, I'm not. I'm little, I am weak, I'm delicate, I am sensitive, I am fragile. You know, it was just like, it never in a million years would have occurred to me to do that affirmation. Never, because it just, but all of a sudden, this enormous, powerful, very sensitive, extremely dear, you know, individual, but very male, just is doing that affirmation. And it just crossed my mind. What a moron you've been all these years. Of course you're strong. Of course you're a strength. I just went, whoom, right into that yang energy, and I loved it. It was just like a whole realization, oh, that's why they're men. You know, that's really nifty, just to be like that, just to, you know, be a soldier, go to war, all the things that men do. I just got it. And more than that, I wrapped my arms around it. And really, I just stopped talking about how sensitive I am. You know, I'd spent a great deal of my life just being so... I thought it was a virtue. I mean, yes, I am sensitive, but God, what a drag, really. Why should I be sensitive? Why not just be strong? Why just... Who cares? Just go through. You see how... Now, where was I with all that? But that's who you're really supposed to be. It's really fun. And then you bring to every situation the capacity to be appropriate. Because what we really want is we want to make ourselves one with the Infinite Spirit so that we can be that to everyone. But if we only have like this much of the spectrum, then we can serve as long as the conditions exactly match exactly how much we have to give. But as soon as they move a quarter of an inch out of it, we're just completely lost. Right? And then how useful are we to anybody? What to speak of ourselves? So we get to practice. We constantly get to practice. And we get to see. Isn't that fascinating? I remember once with David, we went through this big thing where I was really determined. We had about a year-long kind of standoff of wills where I was determined that he should do something or another, which thankfully I've totally forgotten. And he was equally determined that he was just not about to be bullied by me, which I appreciate now. And finally after, it was, you know, those of you who have had long marriages, you understand. You just play these things out. They sound kind of scary to people who haven't been married very long, but if you've been married for a long time, you realize that there's kind of an ebb and flow. My dear friend, one of my dear friends who's been married longer than us, we were all together and, let's see, David and I were having a little bit of a disagreement about something, and when we sat down, we sat on very far apart from each other in this very small room, and because this couple was very good friends of ours, they just made some little remark about it. I said, oh, he doesn't like me very much right now. And the man just looked up. He said, well, you can't always expect to like the person you live with. He just said it just like that. And I thought, that's absolutely true, isn't it? You love them. You wouldn't leave them for anything in the world. You're just completely devoted, but you don't always like them. Because just sometimes, you know, it just gets, something happens. This is, anyway, that's all to explain that we were sort of on this year-long cycle where I had this thought that I was holding and that David was resisting, and therefore, there was just always this undercurrent. And finally, I began to think, this is not working, and maybe I should think differently. I stopped rebelling and went on the quest. The quest is not what do I want. The quest is what is really true. So I decided to interview him, so I interviewed him like a journalist. Are you aware of what it is that I'm trying to make happen? Oh, yes, he said. Well, that was a good start. And then I said, do you think that my idea is a good one? He said, yes, it's a good one. And then he said, but I'm just not interested. I have other priorities in my life. Whoa, was that ever an eye-opener? And then I thought, who am I serving? You know, who? I would never do this to a friend. Because you don't have that illusion of ownership, which comes with relationships where there's an element of compulsion. Now that you are my wife, now that you're my husband, now that I've made your body through my body and you're my child, you know. Just like, you know, children treat their parents. I remembered, I'm going to just tell one more story. This little girl was born here in our community, and it took her about 2 years to forget that she was an old woman. She came out looking like this imperious old woman. And she held that look until she was almost 2 years old, and then she finally began to look like a child. And during that whole time, she just had this attitude of, where are the servants? You know, this situation is just so undignified, and it was just her constant attitude. She just looked so put out. And I was telling, and then she began to lighten up and just kind of, oh, this being a baby is kind of fun. She began to play at being a baby. And I said to her parents, I said, she always looked so imperious, like, where are the servants? And now she seems to have lightened up. And then the father said, because she found her servants, her mother and me. thought, yeah, that's right. That's what little children are like, isn't it? You know, you belong to me. What could you possibly have to do except take care of me? It's just completely, and you know, children very far into their lives, very far into their lives have that thought. What could you possibly have to do except take care of me? You would never treat a friend like that. Now, I don't have time now, so I'll start next week if some of you can help me remember. I want to talk about relationships and trust and love and what you're trusting. It's a very, very important issue. It's a word people love to bandy about. And it's a very important word to get a solid foundation on. So I asked for one question and never asked for a single other. Were there any others? Okay, John, we'll get to try it for a moment.
Is it possible?
I think a person who can't drink out of a cup probably shouldn't be trusted on other levels either. Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that the world is in so much chaos today because there's an imbalance in the yin-yang energy? For example, United States, the way it is right now, especially since 9/11, would that perhaps relate to too much male energy? And
well, you know, I don't think human beings are in charge of the destiny of the planet. I think God is in charge of the destiny of the planet, and we choose to be born on a planet that is going through the karmic cycle that is the appropriate backdrop for our own personal karmic cycle. There's a class that we give here, I don't know how often we give it, but we used to call it planetary and personal evolution. And we would talk about karma from two angles, and so this is how you put it. There is this cosmic karma of a planet, and that the karma of that planet is determined by its place astronomically in relationship to where the energy source of this particular system is related. This is all about the yugas. This is a whole other class which I won't go into, but there are many, many planets to be born onto, and those planets are at different stages of consciousness collectively. And so if you when you're in the astral world and you're out of the material world and you need to take a physical body, you don't always come back to Earth. The master said that. He said, oh no, of course not. He said, there's many, many planets to go to. And you just go to the one that's having the right experience to be the right backdrop for what you personally need to learn. Because your personal karma is not determined by the planetary karma. Your evolution is independent of the planetary karma, but you will choose to be born where they work together. So, yes, what you're saying is true. Obviously, there's enormous things that are out of balance on our planet right now, which is why it's behaving in such a wacko way. I mean, the people on it and even the natural forces itself. But we came here to be part of that experience because that experience is going to benefit us. And in the subsequent weeks, I can refine that point a little bit. And it will happen in its own cycle because its force is bigger than individual egos. This is an enormous amount of thinking these days is so egocentric. Even if it's a collective ego, it's like giving to individual human beings a power that is just ludicrous. We don't have that kind of power. However, being challenged to be responsible and to relate to the things that are happening is important for our personal karma. So we have to behave appropriate to it. But part of behaving appropriately is to come into harmony with the fact that there's greater powers than just the human ego. What's really wrong with this planet is that it's so materialistic and atheistic. And that it's all about the human ego, and people are not working in harmony with anything except what they want. It's just this incredible delusion that money and material comfort and human pleasure is the goal of life. And that's what's really wrong with this planet. But that is what's wrong with this planet. That's the planet we're on. And that's the planet that these particular masters have devoted themselves to help. And it serves us to be part of this. But you can list out a whole lot of things there. And there is a, like an excess of yang energy, and there's an enormous push for more yin energy, and that's why so many women of essentially masculine temperaments were born to behave like men, which is to be very forward and pushy about their feminine energy, which was a bit ironic. But nonetheless, it has been needed, because that's what this planet needed. But you see, Master also was doing the same thing, because his message was to love God as Divine Mother. I mean, essentially, he's the one, he really set the same thing in motion. Time for more yin. Yang has gone about as far as it can go. But yang, too much yang is the least of our problems. We have so much going on, but it's the perfect backdrop. Because we get to practice fear, we get to practice sectarianism, we get to practice hatred, we get to, you know, practice grief, we get to practice self-restraint, we get to practice hedonism, you know, we get to practice anything we want, materialism, we get to buy $500 pairs of shoes and nobody thinks it's crazy. We just get to do wild things on this planet. And some people get to strap dynamite onto themselves and blow themselves up with the thought they're going to go to heaven. Now, that's a real opportunity. But, you know, somebody really needed that. Nuts. And he gets to take thousands of people with him. It's awful. But everybody's here as they're meant to be because of the cross currents, conflicting cross currents of the heart chakra that we need to work out slowly by slowly. And I don't mean that in a fatuous way. I mean that very deeply and seriously. It's not just a brush off, because it's subtle. You can't. It doesn't. That's not an excuse to be irresponsible. People sometimes say, because I mean, I don't vote or anything like that. People ask me, you know, who are you for? I think they just like politics is never going to take me anywhere, as far as I can see. But I'm an intense activist. I mean, I've devoted decades of my life to trying to change this world, but I believe it'll change by individuals understanding the role that God plays in our lives and how to be in tune with that. You know, I've worked my whole life to change the world. It's just, what did I mean by that? By teaching people to meditate and to love God, and it will change the consciousness, because that's the problem. You know, it's all consciousness. There's not a problem on this planet that couldn't be solved. Everybody could be fed. Everybody could be comfortable. All children could be taken care of. Everybody says that. There isn't the will to do it, because there's not the consciousness. Change the consciousness, all the problems go away. Okay, this is it. That's it. If you have other questions, save them for next week. Okay, thank you.